Blog Talk Radio.
Get on.
I would like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. We're looking at May the 28th, 2016, Memorial Day weekend. My special guest is Nick from the 4019s. Nick, are you there?
Yeah, hey, John, how you doing?
Doing really good. How you doing?
Good, man. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. It's always a pleasure. We always have a good time talking music, and I really enjoy you guys' music. And you have a new album out, which we're going to talk about tonight. We played a few songs from that. And I guess we could start the show off, Nick. Talk about the name of the latest release is Rebooted. And your website is the4019s.com.
Correct.
Now, can people purchase that directly from that website, Nick?
Yes, you can. You can get the digital downloads online. We have through Cool Cat Music. You can purchase physical copies, and let's see, CD Baby as well. And we're gearing up to have our physical CDs sold on our site as well. So it's just a matter of time. So.
How is it to do that? I mean, with the way music is now, and with, you know, things like Spotify and all the download sites and things like that, how do you stand, Nick, with getting away from the physical copies? I know some bands don't even produce CDs anymore, and then I know some bands are producing LPs, vinyl, and I know a few that are producing cassettes.
Yeah, we've done cassettes as well. I think we made about 100 or 200. It's kind of more of just like a nice promotional thing, but they're pretty viable right now. A lot of the younger musicians and younger guys in charge of record labels are going with cassettes, and I thought that was a cool idea, so we went ahead and did that. Burger Records, which I think Wiener Records is their subsidiary that handles the cassettes, and there are quite a lot being manufactured, so that's interesting.
Why do you think that's popular right now?
That's a good question. I just think it's just a phase that you're able to. I don't know if it's a, I don't want to say a boutique thing, or it's just something of interest to perhaps a younger audience that didn't experience cassettes back in our day, perhaps, and they're exploring the new medium, you know. And thankfully, people's like, I still like cassettes, you know. People that we've given them to say, hey, I still have a cassette player in my car. So I said, hey,
wow.
Well, there you go, you know.
it's pretty wild. I mean, I go out on and search for some old cassettes every once in a while for my collection, just to have them. I think it's kind of cool to have them. And I also, when you said, you know, if they hadn't really experienced it, when you get your pencil and you put the eraser end down, you try to get the tape to wind back. Do you remember that?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't the greatest. I mean, when CDs came out, it was like the most. It was like magic, you know. This flat disc, you just stuck it in. You didn't have to worry about the tape getting all hosed up and jacked up. And
right.
But I was just wondering, from a marketing standpoint, how you guys stood on that, getting the music out, you know, in a digital format. And, you know, also sometimes I think it's kind of cool, because I've been playing a lot of vinyl lately, and I used to have a record store, so I have a lot of records.
right, sure. Hey, right on. That's very cool.
Yeah, instead of I'm just sitting here, I play them occasionally, which is pretty good. But
yeah.
But it's like, you know, I was just wondering that. So most of the, when you're recording your music, and let's just look, Nick, at this album that we're playing music from tonight.
Right.
When you look at it, your music is, you know, you can categorize it many different ways, but it does have a retro feel to it to me. And when you're playing it and recording it, how do you get the sound that you want? What, first part of the question is, what kind of gear do you use and equipment do you use to get the sound that you want to capture? And then when you're listening back to it, when it's being mastered and all that stuff, are you hearing things in it that digitally that you wouldn't hear otherwise? Or I don't know how that works.
Well, the when we record, our gear essentially is, I don't want to say vintage gear, more like dependable, like a tuxedo or anything that stands the test of time. That's what we like, you know, like our guitars. John and Chuck use, you know, anything from Rickenbackers to Fenders, the Strats, Telecasters, a Gretsch. We like that. That vintage line, I suppose, just because of their durability, that we know their sounds and things like that. And of amplifiers, of course, we're Fenders. We like Vox. John has a Vox AC15. Chuck has a Vox AC. It's a AC1530. It goes either way, but you get a lot of good sounds. And the Vox goes well with the Rickenbacker guitar. So, and then for drums, of course, I use an old Rogers snare from the '60s that I really like. And you have Ludwig drums that they're modern Ludwigs, but again, we try to go with proven, you know, gear. And then when we record, I don't know if it's perhaps just the sounds we're used to hearing, or we just try to. Our goal in the studio is what sounds good. That's the main thing, you know. We don't really try to reinvent anything. We just go in there and say, how do we service the song? The way we write is more, you know, our influences go back to the '50s, some even to the '40s, you know, or a lot of things. So that's our frame of reference. If that answers the question.
Yeah, and I have another question on the drums. A lot of people don't realize what goes into a professional drummer setting up their gear, tuning their gear, getting it just to sound the right way you want to. I think people, and me included, until I started playing in bands and I got around drummers, that how much goes into that. Now, when you said you have a vintage a Rogers snare, what is it that you like out of that, Nick, that brings the sound to you that you couldn't get out of another snare?
Well, I like it. I've always liked the sound of James Brown's drummer in the old days, Clyde Stubblefield. His snare was just the way it sounded. I've always I liked. It's just so crisp and snaps, you know, and a lot of, even in a lot of the '60s rock and roll drummers, you know, that similar sound, and the Rogers and Ludwig drums give that. So many do, but these were the particular drums that I liked. I like that crisp sound that they give, you know. And
How long does it take you to set your kit up and get it right where you want it, if you're doing it by yourself the whole time?
In the studio or live?
Let's say, yeah, performance, live performance.
Oh, yeah. And these days, even back when I was in my 20s, I'd have that kit set up in 10 minutes, 5 minutes. We were known, prior to the 4019s, John and I were in a band called the Leonards, and we now pretty much follow the same code we did back then. When we get on stage, we set up fast and we get off even quicker, because we always respected the band after us. You know, we had to get off stage so they could get on and, you know, get the night, keep the flow going. Nowadays, it seems like when you get on, you know, the house wants to have one set of drums. Well, we always took pride in the fact that, hey, I you know, we can get off the stage quicker than we got on, you know. So, you know, a lot of bands, in my experience, they tended to take their time coming up and getting off, and we were always the opposite. We went in and we had a Ramones approach to everything, you know. We offered the respect going in and coming out of there, you know. It was a very serious thing to us, so, and we do,
you know,
that now too.
Yeah, I love that. I love that approach to it, because, you know, respecting that the other people coming on. You know, I've always wondered how that works sometimes because, you know, I have seen where they have rotating stages, and that's kind of cool because one band can set up and then I know that's expensive and you don't see it a lot, but that would be like the ultimate thing. But it's pretty cool when you're playing now, and you were talking about the amps and the Vox amps and the Fender amps. You know, I've been reading a lot about some of these older bands, and I was reading about Badfinger and when they were, you know, went into the studio and when they were the Ivies and they went in and they started messing around, you know, and then they would record their stuff, and then of course they had these four guys. I don't know if you heard of them, the Beatles, that would come in and listen to it.
Wow.
So that, they were the first rock group that was signed to Apple Records. So they had their sound, knew what they had to do, and they would come in and lay their stuff down. And then they would have these guys come in and say, you know, how about that and how about this? And one of the things they were talking about was in their first mix of Baby Blue, which has that great guitar power chord intro. They didn't like that, and they didn't like the snare drum, and that's what got to me thinking about that, Nick, because they didn't like the way the snare drum sounded, and they said it's got to have more reverb to it. Now, they did that in the studio. How hard is that to do that, to make the drums sound differently once they've already been played?
Oh, you mean once they've been laid the tape, as they say?
I would imagine. That's what it was.
I think generally what would happen is they'd just redo the rehearsal or recording studios will have several snare drums. A lot of times bands will, you know, you'll have your the drummer, at least in the older days, prior to the past several years perhaps, you'd have, you know, the drummer only had one snare drum. Nowadays, drummers are a lot more sophisticated, you know, and they have several snares, or they have a different recording set of cymbals, or record. They have their live kit and their recording kit. At least that's what I've discovered. So, generally, though, I think in Apple, they just say, all right, get rid of that snare. We're going to use this type of snare drum. Now, when it's to tape, I don't know how they would handle that. I know it's, at least in my experience, that once it's recorded, you run into some. You know, we're going to have to do some tricks in the reverb and in the all the effects and, you know.
Yeah, I think that's what they were doing, but I haven't read deeply enough into it. But I was just wondering, from a drummer's perspective, if you know, and we're going to talk about, you know, your latest recording and the production of it and what you guys, when you were listening to it, what you were, you know, what you liked and what you didn't like. Have you ever had any of your recordings, Nick, where you've laid down tracks and then had somebody come in and say, you know what, I think it'd sound better this way or that way, and you would have to make a decision, right? Whether, I mean, it's your music, whether you wanted to accept that or not. Have you ever had run into that?
Many years ago. You know, the thing that is always the issue, I think, once you hope when you get in there and you lay the stuff down that it's right, because it's always, at least in the newer bands, when the band's been around and has this high levels of success, they can redo stuff. But a lot of times you don't have the resources to re-record. Although you can lay the drums down and stuff like that. In my experience, it's never really happened, but I've known people that it's happened to. And, you know, that someone is dissatisfied with a certain sound. So with drums, it's a little harder because once the drums are recorded, then, all right, the drums break down and then everybody sets up the, you know, the amplifiers and stuff like that. So, you know, again, if it's a more successful, you know, a band that's doing it, touring, has all these resources, they can do that. But at the level of a lot of bands, you don't have that luxury, so you have to figure something out, you know, come to some sort of compromise, I suppose.
Do you buy into the less is more when it comes to drumming philosophy, or because I've seen people set up, and I love watch. It drives my wife crazy, and anybody that goes to hear a band with me, because I like to go early, and I like to watch what's going on behind the scenes. But I had an opportunity last summer, and it was just one of the coolest things ever, is to see Paul Kantner before he passed away, who is in Jefferson Starship, and I got there, got there early enough. To go up and watch the guys put things together and watch him kind of fiddle around with stuff. And they're very simple. I mean, their setup was, I think he had two twin reverbs. I think it was like, the drum set was real basic but the sound was incredible. Do you think it's like kind of can be, and I've seen metal bands, that have had drum sets that would take up two or three rooms. So what's your take on that as a drummer? I mean, how do you approach your kit?
I always subscribe when I first started, it's one of those things where you learn as you progress, as you go along. I didn't know about the less is more when I first started, and I as I talk to older musicians, like in L.A., I'm hanging out, I'm talking to, DJ Bonebreak from X. I'm talking to, guys, you just see these, musicians out and you get to chat with them and you learn all these things. And as I developed as a drummer, less is more. I didn't initially agree with that, until I have more knowledge, and I go, yeah, you're right. Less is more. There's the stuff between the notes is where the action is for me. So, I used to hear guys say that, and I didn't initially understand it. Now I got into it more and had more studio time, I understood that. And I said, yeah, you're right. And I did have a hint of that. On my first recording session, I worked with a guy, Rudy Getz, he went on to play with, Carole King and all these. He was a really cool guy to record with, and I understood, watching him, how he recorded and how he did things, and I said, I kind of see what Rudy was up to. I drew back on that as I went in, Just these learning blocks, these things you do, and I several years back I remember what Rudy was doing, And then now with Dave Newton, he's the same way, our engineer producer. It's like we service the song. Song comes first, so that's what I learned at least, and everyone in the band is the same way. So.
That's. I think it does take a while to figure that out, but the more I see it, what's going on, it's like I've heard people talk about like groups that would come out with stacks and stacks of Marshalls, and not get the sound nearly as clear or as perfect as like Clapton can get out of one vintage twin reverb.
Right.
It's just about the sound. Like you said, it's what it sounds like. And people, it's not the impression of, look what I've got, look what I can do.
Exactly. Well, you mentioned Paul Kant and his process. To me, his vocals were incredible, really. Man, he did such a great backing for the band. But his guitar, it's just incredible. I would love to have seen that. I'm glad you got to experience that. Because, again, going back to our producer, Dave, I asked him one time about, what do you tell guys who, inquire about your sound? He has a great sound. And Dave always says, man, it isn't the amp or the guitar, it's the fingers. It's in the fingers, So I put that same advice into the drums, So it's in the hands. It's in the that's what I.
Yeah, it's good. It's like an expression. You know, the instrument is an expression of the person, and if you hear a soul singer or somebody singing from the heart, I mean, it
Yeah.
can just totally change you because it's incredibly real. And when you
Right.
hear a guitar player or a drummer or a keyboard player playing from that same area, that same spot, you know, like what I kind of look at as an honest place, you know, where their
Right.
music, wow, you can tell such a difference. But it's a great point when you're talking about somebody producing, because that's their thing, right? That's what they're getting paid for,
Right.
is to hear and to I guess to interpret it, and then to make sure that the musicians that are paying the money are getting the
Right.
best that they possibly can.
Right.
My guest is Nick Ziegler from the band The 4019s, and you can go on their website, 4019s.com. The latest release is Rebooted. We played a couple of songs to start to show off with that. And Nick, why don't we talk about the new album?
Sure.
Where did it, how does it start? When a band or a group of guys start getting a concept or an idea for an album, is it come from a group of songs that you've collected, or is it the other way around where you start writing songs around an idea? How did it work with you guys with the latest release?
I think it, more than anything, the last two records we've just been going into a from the first our first record, No Expiration Date. We had a, you know, we had a an idea where we were. John and I go way back. Chuck, of course, he's in the same influence realm as we are, maybe a little younger, and so, but the same bulk of ideas and references and things. And John and I, of course, have always loved garage rock. You know, we always in Los Angeles. You know, as if you know, you have the bands you enjoy, and every day we, you know, when we were young, you know, we'd go by. Hey, there's Sunset Sound. That's where they the Doors recorded their first two records. That's where the Wrecking Crew worked. You know, this
Wow,
is it.
yeah.
All this stuff going on, you know, and we're like, holy cow, man, this everything that we learned or listened to when we were little kids, it's right, you know, it's and it's everywhere in the world, but I'm, you know what I mean, it's just
Yeah.
so condensed right there. Not saying that it's any more different than anyone, but that history was there for us, so that's what we enjoyed, you know. So and anyway, we were always guitar rock guys, we like the garage rock guys, we like that type of stuff. So now with this first two records, we kind of we were really focusing, and then this Rebooted, we just for whatever reason, man, that's where we went. You know, we really drew from those guitar rock influences. We had a lot of Americana kind of stuff in the first record. It kind of started threading into more all garage, you know, and we wanted to explore a little more, if that makes sense, you know, and
Yeah.
or if I'm explaining it properly. But so John came up with, you know, we wanted to do a number. He gave us this song, True, True, True. He said, hey, he's playing. I really want it to sound like the early Who from, like, Who Sell Out type stuff. So I right away, I knew what he's talking about, you know. And so I thought, all right, cool. So we ran the song, and then we just fine-tuned it. And it, to me, reminds me of something right off of, like, Who Sell Out or, you know, that early success, that freak beat, you know, stuff from those days. So that influence for us on this whole record, that really was the influence. We really said, yeah, this is, it just came naturally for us, I guess.
Well, let's play that song. That would be a great segue into it. And a lot of times when people, you know, when I talk to bands and they say, you know, they're influenced by the Who or they're influenced by the Kinks or whoever, and it's a good thing. It's not like, okay, because you guys have your own sound, but you can definitely
Thanks.
Feel the roots of where it comes from. And I think, you know, that's, I've heard bands that, you know, you're thinking, yeah, that sounds a lot like this or that, but that doesn't mean they don't sound like themselves. You know what I mean? Does that make
Right.
sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure does. I appreciate
Yeah.
that.
Well, let's
And they,
play True. Yeah, go
oh,
ahead.
yeah, absolutely.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about this song before we
Well,
play it?
yeah, you know, we're influenced by the offshore radio and the AM radio and stuff like that. So the introduction will kind of hopefully when your younger listeners hear it, they might explore some old AM radio sound bites on their YouTube.
Okay. Well, let's play it. This is True, 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 the 4019s. We'll be right back with our conversation with Nick after this.
10-9-8-7-6-5-4-3-2-1-1-1-1.
From the 4019's latest album, Rebooted. Now, Nick, as a drummer, that kind of reminded me a little bit of the early Animals. I don't know why, but I kind of got that vibe a little bit from it. Kind of has a bluesy rock sound to it.
I'll take that. Yeah. Absolutely, man. Thank you.
When you're listening to, you were saying you guys were, you know, like listening to The Who and had that Who vibe. How does it, as a drummer with your own style, and you're listening to Keith Moon's drumming,
mm-hmm.
how does that influence you? Because, you know, I've never had a chance to see Keith Moon play live when he was alive, and I would think, you know, you can go on YouTube and you can see the films and stuff.
Right.
But from a layman's view of not being a drummer, it almost looked like he was almost out of control, but he never was. How would you describe his drum playing, and how when you're listening to a Who song and you're trying to capture that vibe, you might think, wow, how do I get that the way that Moon did it?
The Moon did it, right. You know, Daltrey made a really good assessment of Moon's playing when he said Moon liked to play to the melody. So when Daltrey would be singing the verse, that's when Moon would be playing, you know, doing tom hits and stuff like that. And I said, oh, there you go. That makes sense. Because when you hear it, you're like, well, what's he doing here? A lot of drummers will misinterpret, and they'll just play all over. It's a really fine line, and Moon walked that line like no other drummer that I've ever seen. Maybe Mitch Mitchell was another good one, Hendrix's old drummer. But
right, yeah.
That's just a super fine razor's edge that Moon pulled off, and also with the help of Entwistle and the fact that Townsend was more rhythmic as a guitar player. So I think that was the best explanation I've ever heard of Moon's style.
Yeah.
You know,
I would have never thought of that. That's really good.
Yeah,
and I think also as a drummer, you know, I've always thought, and you know, you heard a lot that they connect with the bass player because, you know,
sure,
they're laying down the bottom and they're connected. And
mm-hmm.
Entwistle was one of the best bass players I thought there was. It
right.
was incredible. I mean, it was just listening to him sometimes when I would listen to certain bass players, and I would think, they're not trying to sound like these guys from the 60s and 70s, Nick. They weren't
mm-hmm.
trying to sound like anybody else. They were just playing. And then people
right.
are now trying to break it down and say, well, what were they doing, you know?
Right.
But, yeah. And when you're doing
a
bass, yeah, I just have a thought real quick. When you're doing a bass run like Entwistle would be playing, you know, right along with everything, then he would kind of go off on these runs. He would do
right.
some runs. Do you have to do that in correlation with the drums? I mean, how does that work? Because do you watch that when the bass player maybe is going to go out and improvise a little bit, or is it not connected that well?
No, it's definitely connected. I think when you're playing with someone, like for as long as those guys play, that they're able to read. You know, they'll. It's not only auditory there; it's a visual where they're. You when you're playing a lot of times you read body language too, you know, you'll so there's a number of different things, and they'll say, oh, this is where, you know, he's going to go into his and then that comes with experience. Oh, he's going to do a bass roll here, I'm going to lay back and let him do his thing. Or you're able to, you know, it's just one of those things that comes with experience and time and play with the people, and you're really comfortable with their style and so forth. So,
yeah,
I think at least maybe that was the magic with those two guys, with Moon and Entwistle. You know,
yeah,
they really connected. They were both just out of control and stylistically, and they just complemented each other.
Yeah, I think it's like controlled chaos a little bit because it sounded like I've heard Moon playing where I thought. It's almost like he's not going to come back to where he needs to come back to, but he
right.
always did.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I thought, yeah, that always made me a little. I don't know why I'm saying this, but it would make me nervous when I was listening to him sometimes because I was thinking, is he going to come back to where he needs to be? Because he's just out there, man. He just went. But you know, he always. I don't know why it made me nervous. That doesn't make any sense. But
sure.
Always, he always came back, and he always hit. Right, Townsend and all that.
Right. I sometimes I'll hear, well, he was one of my main influence as a drummer and coming up. And then I shifted to other different drummers and listening and styles and so forth. But the one compliment that I always thought was the best thing anyone ever gave for my playing was the fact that they would say, hey, you know, you went off on these crazy rolls on this thing and, all of a sudden, you went out of time, and you bounced right back into time. An old friend of mine, a guitarist, that used to tour all over the place, he said that to me, and I said, well, hey, I'm doing my job then, because timing is the main thing, you know. And
yeah.
So I always took that as a high compliment, so I don't know what it is, but anyway, that always made me feel as a drummer I was doing my job, so, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I've heard. I went to a blues club open mic once, and there was a guitar player. I won't say his name. He's pretty good around here, pretty well known. And he was playing, and you know, it's an open mic, so they had different people coming in and sitting down and playing. And he's incredibly serious about his skills and everything, and kind of is known for that. And this kid sat down, and started playing the drums. He
oh,
just
wow.
turned around and looked at him and like, he said, you know what we're doing, what time we're in. And the kid just like, well, you know, he played again and he stopped him again. It was like, I thought, yeah, that's kind of, I don't know if it was rude or it was like, you know, they're just jamming. So, but,
right.
But I knew he wanted, you know, it meant a lot to him because everything he did, and he still does, takes it,
right.
Like, if he plays a jam at the Blue Dolphin, which was the club it was, it would be the same thing to him if he was in Carnegie Hall. It wouldn't be any different. So, so let's continue to talk about the album. So, how did the songwriting come? How did you select the songs, Nick? And was there, like, some left on the cutting floor?
No, we had John came in with several ideas, and then again we were in that garage, like I said, that garage rock kind of vibe, and John, you know, like I said, he brought in several songs, and then we ironed them out, and I had a couple of tracks, and we wanted to do two just really interesting covers, and so we figured the goal was around 12 songs, because we've discussed it with our, you know, with Dave, our producer, and other folks, and I think for us 12 works fine. If you go over 12, and besides, our disc is only like 32 minutes long. That's pretty, you know, old school, I think, but
yep. It
seems to be the way it's coming back. I've noticed some newer bands are going into like the 30-minute range. Remember any, like, in the 90s, it would be like 74 minutes. They'd try and jam everything into that CD, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was our goal. We like to write songs that are, we try to aim under 3 minutes, you know, 2.5. And how do we get this to where it's, you know, we just come in and you know, the old songs, when you listen to them, the archetype rock and roll songs were 2.5 minutes, and they sounded like they were 4 minutes, you know. That's a good song, you know.
Yep.
So that was always our goal, was to, like, write a song that's short, that it just sounds like it's longer than two minutes or something. It just, there's a lot going on. So anyway, that was our goal.
Do you think it plays into a short attention span that's going on right now with musicians, but with the consumers, because
right.
I don't know. I kind of go back. You were talking about the Doors, and I can remember when Light My Fire came out, and they had the long solos, you know, that they cut out
seven.
Of the
yeah.
And I loved that. I thought it was super cool and awesome. But
right.
But I'm not sure how the record company looked at it, or the radio stations, because the radio stations, or we could play 3 songs, you know,
right.
within this. Do you think that people have that patience now to listen to a longer song? Because I like the short songs too, because I grew up in that period where you could get a lot done in 2.5-3 minutes,
right?
And the songs were great. I mean, what do you think about that?
It seems the era of the album as a entire piece is kind of no longer, where, you know, there's just a quick example. Like, I was listening to Townsend just recently, because of their touring and stuff, and Daltrey said that after I Can See for Miles, they thought that was going to be their big single. Everything up to that time in those days, so what was that, 67, everybody went for the single.
Yeah.
And so after that song didn't take, Townsend said, oh, screw this, I'm going to write albums. You know, like, for lack of a better term, the concept. So, and I think that's around the same time with the Doors, right, and Light My Fire, that the album became like a whole piece, you know, and then through the 70s and the 80s, it kind of weaned away, and so I think that's where we are now, and with the advent of, you know, MP3s and you know, purchasing a single, that we're back in that era. I don't know. Do you think that's the case? That's what I see, at least, that the era of the album is kind of, you know, it'll resurface, but I don't think that's where we are right now.
I think it's a great point. I've talked to people that artists that are putting out music now, Nick, and they're thinking in the mind of, okay, used to be like side one, side two, right? And
Yeah.
you had that, and people knew that. They grew up that way. You'd have the liner notes. You'd have everything there. You could like follow things through as you went. Now I think it's more of a mobile way. People aren't like sitting down and listening to music as much as they used to give them
Right.
music. It's like in the car, on the go, that kind of thing. Like an instant gratification type thing where,
Right.
okay, I got to hit this and I want to hear it and I want to hear this jolt or whatever I want from it. But I think back, you know, I can remember that those days here in Columbus, Ohio, it was all pop, and they had a great pop station here, WCOL. It was if you've seen the movie is it That Thing You Do with
Yeah.
the Tom Hanks movie? They come to the Ohio State Fair, and they have a
Right.
whole thing with Spook Beckman, who was the DJ, and that whole thing. And that was pretty cool. But then what happened was they came out with an FM station,
Right.
and the FM station was underground, and
Right.
they played all album oriented rock, and that was so awesome back then, because then you could listen to, they would play the entire side of the Doors. They would play Moody Blues, you know,
Right.
the whole suite of music. And to me, and Jethro Tull and bands like that, it would take a little bit of, I don't know, dedication to listen to it. I mean, you
Sure.
had to really listen. It wasn't just I heard that and it made me dance. It was
Yeah.
like I heard that and wow, that was pretty heavy, you
Yeah,
know.
you took it in. Remember, you would, to this day, when I hear certain song, I'm immediately expecting, like track two from that album come up, right?
That's a good point.
So,
Yeah.
yeah, so I am definitely with you on that. It was an experience. I used to sit on my front porch. I'd bring out my record player and I would put an album on, and it'd be like, late at night, and I would just sit there and listen to the thing. A hot night, but I lived in Pittsburgh, so just to get out of the try to get the breeze going, I'd put my record player outside just to try to cool off, and then I'd listen to a whole album. I'd listen to several albums till I fell asleep or whatever. But yeah, no, the listening habits are, going cycles perhaps.
Yeah, I agree with that. So when you were putting the album together, did you guys have in mind in the songwriting and in the production of the album a certain feel? This is what we wanted to just portray, or did the songs come as individuals, or did they kind of fit together?
They kind of fit together. We were just curious as far as track orders, how they should go. Towards the end of the record, 8 and 9 and 10, Dave Newton suggested, "Hey, why don't you move? There are two songs with similar tempo. Switch, put that, drop that one down, put a quicker song up next, So." And I said, yeah, it definitely there's a flow to it, and we worked on that to give it, you know how it is, it's a couple songs and a listener, you want a more slower paced song, or it's like a movie, where a movie has a bunch of action and it slows down for a minute, the audience gets a breather, and then it picks up again, you kind of take a breather again. So I guess, yeah, that whatever that format is, it for storytelling or whatever, that's what we try to do with this record.
Now, is there any new projects, Nick, or anything going on, anything like that you'd like to talk about that's going on with the band?
Yeah, well, actually, this week on Sirius Underground Garage. Friday they're debuting I'm Free is their coolest song in the world, so we're pretty excited about that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's
Thanks.
a great station. And yeah, congratulations on that. I mean,
Thank you.
it's one of the things where I listen to a lot of music, and but I love that the kind of music you guys put out. I love the garage rock. I like the just the rock and roll. It doesn't have to be like conceptual. It doesn't have to be extravagant, but it's got to have that driving and that heart, you know. And I think you guys
Right.
really nailed that in this album. And Yeah, I'm Free is a really good song. Talk about that a little bit. We played that to start the show off.
Right. Yeah, you know, that song was, John always mentions on stage when we play it, that his brother-in-law was going through, sadly going through a divorce, and he was talking to John about it, and there are a couple of phrases in there that John says, I'm going to make there's a song in there, as he said. So it's a life experience, you know. And John does a lot of that, obviously. He things he writes about, he just observes and either he experiences it. And actually, his brother-in-law says, you know, is off to better places now. So it's all good, you know. So this in the song, just and we also say it all starts now. That's the beginning. Everything, no matter where you are, and if you're at your darkest spot, you know, at a time, now is when it starts. You know, you could start over right now. So that's kind of the idea of that song. You know.
Yeah, that's a really good part, and I think it's so cool that you know people can that are gifted songwriters. You know, Nick, that can do that. They can take like everyday things that happen and write a song about it and capture that feeling, because that's what it's to me. Then you hear that and you think, oh man, yeah, I've been through that. Yeah,
yeah.
I would tell the story. I don't know if you've heard of the Doughboys out of New Jersey.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah.
Yeah. I interviewed them once and I was going to play this one song and, I think Richard, the drummer, said, you can't play that. And I said, well, why not? He goes, that reminds me of my ex-wife. And he was just joking, but it's one of those things where, you know, you play the songs and you may forget about that part of your life, but it comes back, you know, and we do that in our lives with music and things like that. Well, Nick, it's great having you on. I really always appreciate talking to you. The best of luck to the band. Any ideas for a new album? Or are you?
We're writing right now, and we're predicting probably within a year, I'd say. We'll have under a year. So we have most of the songs together. We just gotta hammer them out, as they say, and you know. Recording is always a blast. We love going in there to record, so we're looking forward to it.
Well, that's great. And the website is 4019s.com, and that's where the fans and people out there can keep up with you and the band. And
right.
Okay.
Oh, I also wanted to just say quickly. I know you're right outside of Columbus, right? So.
Right.
I grew up in Pittsburgh, and there's the last remaining York Steakhouse is in Columbus. So next time I'm coming through, I'm going to give you a call, and we're going to go hit York Steakhouse.
That is so funny. It's real close to where we live too. It's
on.
Yeah, and it's got the it looks just like it did in the old days. And
awesome.
My wife's eaten there since I have, and she said the food is basically the same as it was. So
right.
Yeah,
we'll
definitely do that. That's so funny because people don't know that, you know, that was a big deal back then.
The
Ponderosa steakhouses and all that stuff going on. I never really understood what exactly that meat was, but
right, yeah.
Okay, yeah, but we'll do that, Nick. That'll be great. So thanks so much. We really appreciate it. We'll keep in touch. Best of luck to you and the guys. And,
okay, John. I'll spread the word to them.
Yep, and have a great Memorial Day weekend, Nick.
Okay, you too. Thanks again, and I appreciate your chatting with me.
It's my pleasure. We'll talk to you later. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Independent Showcase tonight, John Talk Radio. And we'll go out with a couple of songs from the 4019s. Everybody have a great day.